You weren't the lawyer below, were you?
May it please the Court, Francesca Fritchero on behalf of Appellant William Burge.
Okay. Did you represent him in the trial court?
I did not represent him in the trial court. No, my colleague in the Federal Defender's Office did.
Who?
A colleague of mine in the Office of the Federal Defender represented him in the district court.
Okay.
May I reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal?
Sure.
With the Court's permission. When faced with a recidivist sentencing statute, competent counsel spots a potential issue. And that issue is the question of whether the previous conviction must be suffered before the commission of the crime for which the defendant faces sentencing.
How do you know it's part of the affidavit?
I read.
I agree. I don't believe counsel for Mr. Burge spotted the issue. I think that competent counsel would have. That's exactly the ineffectiveness. In other words, whenever in a criminal sentencing there's a statute whose phrase includes a defendant who has been previously convicted, it at least raises the question whether that previous conviction has to have been suffered before the defendant committed the crime for which he faces sentencing. And then counsel would explore whether that is, in fact, a plausible argument to make about the statute. And when the text of the statute and legal theory, logic concerning the purposes in criminal sentencing, and decisions from other jurisdictions all combine to make a persuasive argument that the statute should not apply to that particular defendant because he had not been convicted before he committed the crime for which he faced sentencing, then counsel must object to the application of that statute absent a strategic reason for not doing so. Counsel in this case did not do that.
He didn't even read the statute.
It appears that he did not even read the statute.
Didn't even know it was there.
He did not calculate the defendant's exposure in any way.
Didn't do the arithmetic.
He said to the court that he did not do the arithmetic. That's correct.
The Supreme Court of Oregon somehow came to the conclusion that the statute was not sufficiently ambiguous that a reasonable lawyer would have recognized the ambiguity. I don't think the legal test for the clause is wrong. Whether a reasonable lawyer would have recognized the issue. The question really seems to me is whether that rather odd decision, since everybody else found it ambiguous, whether that decision is an unreasonable application.
Yes. First, I do think the Oregon Supreme Court was incorrect, but the unreasonable part of its decision was that it based its decision on the words within the statute alone. In other words, the Oregon Supreme Court was saying that sentencing counsel would look only to the words of the statute and, in this instance, it said, would not have perceived the ambiguity there. What's unreasonable about that is that that's not what competent counsel's job is. The appellate court, in construing the words of the statute, has that job. But competent counsel has more to do than simply interpret the texts in the text of the statute. In other words, I don't know that that is accurate. If the statute unambiguously said something that was at odds with some other principle of the law, I believe competent counsel might still have to object. The point is, it's not just the ambiguity of the words that give counsel the duty to object to its application to the defendant. In other words, a statute could very, very clearly state something against which counsel should have an argument because of some other principle or some conflicting legal theory, and then the duty to object would arise. Respondent argues that having this obligation on counsel at sentencing is akin to forcing counsel to be prescient, as if what the Oregon Supreme Court did later when it interpreted the recidivist sentencing statute was a novel interpretation of the law. I think that's incorrect. What the Oregon Court of Appeals said it was doing when it addressed that statute was merely announcing a logical conclusion that previously convicted in the recidivist sentencing statute means convicted before the commission of the crime for which the defendant faces sentencing. And courts in many other jurisdictions had held the same principle to be the case. Kansas, Kentucky, South Dakota, Colorado, many other places had interpreted similar statutes in this way. It is incorrect to say that what happened in the court's decision in Allison was a novel interpretation. It is one that is very familiar in sentencing theory, that the offender is punished more harshly if he goes out and commits a crime having already been convicted and prosecuted for an offense. It is indeed hornbook law in criminal procedure. There are courts that have disagreed with that principle, but it's clearly a well-recognized one. The cases that respondent cites in support of that position also deal with very different kinds of interpretation of the law. In one instance, it's a case about the interpretation of Oregon's felony murder statutes. In another, it's about a legal decision that came down 4 years after the proceeding at issue, which actually changed pre-existing case law. Allison, in this instance, was not that sort of novel interpretation. It didn't require much creativity to read the statute and believe that previously convicted meant convicted before he committed the crime. The other point that respondent makes is that there were two decisions in Oregon based on the application of the Oregon sentencing guidelines, which would have dissuaded competent counsel from making the argument that the recidivist sentencing statute did not apply. Those two, that argument is incorrect. First, it was rejected by the Oregon Court of Appeals in Allison. Second, it wasn't even considered by the Oregon Supreme Court in its decision. But more importantly, rules interpreting sentencing guidelines, as opposed to rules concerning the sentence for the substantive offense, are familiar to most criminal practitioners as apples and oranges. In other words, the recidivist sentencing statute was, as its title indicated, a penalty for a certain type of felony conviction. The Oregon administrative rules governing criminal history was about how to apply the Oregon sentencing guidelines, and those distinctions are like those we are familiar with in federal court about the difference between, say, the application of the Armed Career Criminal Act versus the application and calculation of a person's criminal history.
I want to ask you two questions. Did you find any Ninth Circuit authority holding that trial counsel's failure at sentencing to, you know, comprehend the law and argue against the state's recommendation for a harsher penalty amounts to ineffective assistance of counsel?
I did not cite any such cases in the brief. I relied on U.S. Supreme Court authority in Darden v. Wainwright about the Strickland standard applying at sentencing.
Well, but did you find, I just asked, did you find any Ninth Circuit authority on that?
Ninth Circuit, none that, no, not in the briefing.
Now, how about authority from other circuits?
I believe I stopped in the briefing with the Supreme Court authority and did not look to the authority from other circuits. But there's none included in the briefing.
Uh-huh. There is authority in other circuits. So you missed it. Okay. And then let me ask you this. Which is your stronger argument, that the Oregon Supreme Court unreasonably applied Strickland, or that the Oregon Supreme Court's decision involved an unreasonable determination of the facts?
A stronger argument is that the Oregon Supreme Court unreasonably applied Strickland.
Okay. Good. All right.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Tim Sylvester for Respondent Superintendent Bellick.
Don't you think that the RM student is rather lower
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question, Your Honor.
Don't you think the Oregon Supreme Court expressed a rather low view of the ability of Oregon lawyers to Supreme Court?
No, Your Honor.
They said the Oregon lawyer wouldn't recognize that this was ambiguous?
Let me ask you, let me explain that, if I can. Counsel over and over and over and over again calls this a recidivist statute. It is not a recidivist statute. The other thing to keep in mind is that this statute was initiated by the people. It was voted on by the people. This was not enacted by the legislature. And so the legislative history of this, in interpreting this particular statute, it is unreasonable to go out and say, what is the law in Kansas? What is the law in Alaska? What does ALR say about these kind of statutes? The question is, what would a voter in the state of Oregon in 1988, when ballot measure 4 was enacted, how would they interpret this statute?
It doesn't matter what the language of the statute is.
Well, take
the identical statute
in two states, if other states want to interpret their statute for whatever judicial reasons narrowly, is one thing. In Oregon, though, we don't go and look at the statutes of other states. We look at the plain text of the statute. We look at the legislative history of the statute. If you look at the plain
text. If the statute was passed by the legislature, you would have a different answer than if it was passed by the initiative?
Well, actually, in Oregon, no, because either way, under Oregon, we interpret statute according to their plain text. If you look at the plain text of this statute, what it says, when in the case of a felony described in subsection 2 of this section, a court sentences a convicted defendant who has previously been convicted of any felony designated in subsection 2, so forth. There is nothing in this statute that says when the defendant previously was convicted before he committed this crime. It doesn't say that. Any person looking at this statute, the plain text, a voter, a person on the street taking a look at this would say, that means if at the time of sentencing the guy has prior conviction, it applies.
Only someone trained in the law would know otherwise, like the members of the Oregon Court of
Appeals. Well, right. I mean, what we have here is a
situation.
What we have here is a situation, and with all due respect to the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Oregon Court of Appeals decision in Allison is simply wrong. It has always been wrong. It makes no sense to me. And when this issue got up before the Oregon Supreme Court in this case, it came.
All it has to do is raise an argument. What do you have to lose to say that the Oregon Court of Appeals is wrong and it couldn't be otherwise interpreted? Obviously, it couldn't, because the Oregon Court of Appeals is wrong. They found that it did say that. It concluded. But just to say there's a possible argument,
well,
the
question, I don't believe, is whether there is a possible argument. The question is whether, under Strickland, a reasonable lawyer, under the circumstances then existing, under the case law as it then existed, would have seen this argument and pursued it. And the answer that the Oregon Supreme Court said is, when you look at the plain text of the statute before the Allison decision, it is not unreasonable for a lawyer to assume that the circumstances in which this defendant found himself were such that he was subject to this statute. Because in this situation, if you recall, he committed a burglary, sexual assault. Different victims, different days, etc. He was convicted of them all before he was sentenced, and then he was sentenced at the same time. At the time ballot measure 4 was presented to the voters, the proponents of ballot measure 4 said, we want to get repeat offenders. And if you look at this, burglary, sexual assault, ask anybody on the street, is that a repeat offender? And they would say, yes.
You don't ask anybody on the street what's a reasonable interpretation of the statute. You want to ask lawyers and judges.
Well, but in interpreting this statute, the question is, what would the voters on the street have intended? Pardon me?
What they did is do is not what they thought they would do.
Well, that's true.
So but if they didn't do what they thought they were doing, it's the lawyer's duty to say, look, this guy isn't clear. Here's one interpretation of it.
That's true. I don't disagree with you, Your Honor, on that. But what we have is the Court of Appeals opinion in Allison, which finally interpreted the statute in the way that I think it has no support. There was a strong dissent saying that the majority's interpretation was not plausible. And then this issue came up roundaboutly in this case in the Supreme Court in Burge, where it was an appeal from post-conviction proceedings. So the Supreme Court in Burge, this case, did not need to resolve whether Allison was correctly decided as far as interpreting the statute. But the majority of the Supreme Court in Burge very clearly said, very clearly conveyed that this is...
Well, you know, how could it not be ambiguous?
To me, it's not ambiguous. Well, you know, my view is when you look at this, this is clear as the...
Well, what, you know, you look at this phrase here. A court sentences a convicted defendant. All right, they're sentencing this person now because he's been convicted, who has previously been convicted of any felony. So that means that the felon, the person who convicted a felony who's now before the court, has a prior felony conviction.
That's right. And the previously, as an adverb, relates back to when the person is sentenced. And so the previously, under normal grammatical construction, means that at the time the person is being sentenced, was he previously convicted? That's been our point all the way through. This means exactly what it says. What the Court of Appeals said in Allison is, no, 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 this means, was he convicted at the time he committed this offense? Well, that's not anywhere in this statute.
The court sentences a convicted defendant.
Were all three of these crimes, were they consolidated for sentencing?
Yes.
So there was one sentence imposed, taking in consideration all three of them.
Well, what happened was is that he was tried separately on all the different charges.
For sentencing, they were all consolidated.
Correct. And when the court imposed sentence, it imposed sentence on the first convictions, set of convictions first. Then it adjusted the defendant's criminal history score under the Miller-Buchholz rule, where you count prior convictions, and then adjusted the criminal history for purpose of imposing on the second set, and then did the same for the third set. And then when it imposed sentence on the second set, it said, well, he has a prior conviction. Now he has a previous conviction for burglary, so he is subject to this statute because of the previous conviction. And, I mean, that's entirely consistent with the practice that the Supreme Court adopted in the Miller-Buchholz case that is for purposes of calculation of criminal history. And so back in 1994, when this case was being sentenced, we had Miller-Buchholz on the books, which indicated that, you know, for purposes of conviction and sentencing, if you are sentencing in a consolidated proceeding, a bunch of crimes committed that were entered in separate cases, you take into account the first group of convictions that were sentenced when imposing sentence on the second group of convictions, and then you take those into account when imposing sentence on the third group. And that's the Miller-Buchholz rule. And the assumption was, prior to Allison, that that's the same thing that this statute requires.
Is there anything in the record
that shows that he had ever directed the statute? Well, his affidavit, all it says in the affidavit, and that's in... Well, he didn't mention the statute, but that was in the petition, and he was responding to the claim. And this was obviously in response to the claim. And that said, excerpt of record 53. At that point, in my experience as a criminal attorney, I had enough experience to know the sequence in which convictions, sentences are meted out should be in the same sequence as the conviction. Additionally, Miller and Buchholz had recently been decided, and I was aware that the sentencing court could use previous convictions to boost a defendant's criminal history score. And so what he is essentially saying, I believe, is that he assumed, as I think most people did at that time, that this statute would be applied and construed the same way as Miller-Buchholz rule, and that is when the person is being sentenced, does he have a previous conviction? Yes, he was just sentenced on that one. He was convicted and sentenced, and so he has a previous conviction when he is sentenced for this one. I mean, it seems obvious to me. Now, the Court of Appeals...
Well, I mean, you know, previously been convicted. You could read in there who had been convicted before committing, you know, the instant offense. Or you could read it the other way, who has previously been convicted.
Well, which gets me back...
So, you know, there is some ambiguity there. And an argument could have been made on that score, but wasn't. But the lawyer wasn't even aware of this section.
Oh, I think I think it's clear that he was aware of the statute.
And he didn't make any... Well, I don't know whether he was or not, but he certainly didn't make the argument. He didn't do his arithmetic. And then, lo and behold, an Oregon Court of Appeals made the argument for him. So if he'd been successful in making that argument, it would have knocked off, 4.5 years off this sentence?
Well, that's one other thing I want to clarify. The sentence that he got is not at issue, and that is that the term of months that he got is entirely lawful.
Yeah, whether it's a determinate or indeterminate sentence.
Well, yeah, the only thing is that the application statute means that he's disqualified from earned time credits against that sentence, which is entirely speculative, but I'm not going to say that there isn't prejudice in that respect. But the other thing I want to point out is that, as so far, Allison is simply a decision by the Oregon Court of Appeals. There has not been a definitive decision by the Oregon Supreme Court on what this statute means. And so it's still not clear, even under Oregon law now. Well, I guess the question is, and this is the cases that we cite in our brief, and that is a lawyer supposed to anticipate something novel, some change in the law, some construction of a statute that is not readily foreseeable? And I think the answer is that when you look at this statute, what the Oregon Supreme Court was saying is, even if Allison was correctly decided, which the Supreme Court did not decide in Burge, even if you assume that it was correctly decided, the fact of the matter is no reasonable lawyer would have anticipated that. Because when you look at the face of the statute...
Are the judges so much smarter than the lawyers here? The judges understood no reasonable lawyer would have understood
that? Well, my understanding of the particular standard under Strickland is that the lawyer is not a guarantor in the sense that you are supposed to see everything that is going to happen in the future. You are supposed to see every claim argument that you can make. You're only expected to see those that reasonably you can anticipate. And what the court said in Burge is that what Strickland says and cases of this court has said is you don't look at this in hindsight. You look at it in the context of when this occurred with the lawyer, when this actually did occur. And back in 1994, before Allison was decided, and you have Miller-Buchholz on the books, and you have, I want to point out, we have other what are actually recidivist statutes in Oregon that very clearly say if you commit a crime after having been sentenced and served that sentence, then you get an enhanced sentence. So we do have in Oregon statutes that are constructed that way. This statute is not. And I think that when you look at it, a reasonable lawyer back in 1994 could say, I don't really have a plausible argument here.
Well, but he could read it again another way. A court sentences a convicted defendant who has previously been convicted. So you got someone who's convicted in front of you who has previously been convicted. You could argue that that means that he was previous to the commission of the crime for which he is standing sentenced for, he had been previously convicted of one of those designated felonies. I mean, it's not clear.
Well, I will admit there's some awkwardness in the language, and you get that when you have citizen-initiated ballot measure.
No, I mean, the lawyers wrote this, too. Somebody didn't sit down in front of a fireplace and scribble this out. They probably went to at least a $250-an-hour lawyer, don't you think?
But, you know, and if a lawyer reasonably diligent would have gone and looked at the legislative history, which would have been the ballot measure and the voters' pamphlet, they would have seen over and over again, we want to get repeat offenders. And he would be looking and said, well, he committed a burglary, committed a burglary, committed a burglary. That's repeat offender. And I think, and so even if you went to the legislative, and the only way that the Oregon Court of Appeals said that there was actually, well, there's some ambiguity here and we need to construe it this other way, is they ignored the plain language, they ignored the legislative history, and then they went off and looked at ALR and articles and decisions from Alaska. And it's like, why would anybody reasonably expect that a citizen of the state of Oregon voting on a ballot measure would do legal research into the way recidivist statutes are interpreted in Alaska?
Well, Judge Kleinfeld would.
So I think my time is done. Thank you.
It sure is.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I think a reasonable Oregon voter would still ask, what does it mean, previously been convicted? If they're thinking at all about their vote, we have to assume that someone's reading that statute and thinking, what is this about? To whom does this state want to deny good time? It's the guy who's previously been convicted. Logic, not just the law, suggests that that person is the person who was unreformed after having been convicted and goes out again and commits another crime. It's not particularly legalistic. The voters also would have interpreted that statute in that way. I don't mean any magic words by calling it recidivist. I mean it's talking about people who previously have been convicted. It's about the person who had the chance to reform through the criminal justice system coming down on him and still chose not to. My opponent keeps referring to how we interpret text. We interpret text. Well, the Oregon appellate courts interpret text, but I don't think that that's the standard for the criminal attorney at sentencing. That lawyer must also interpret text and come up with arguments against the application of a statute if such an argument is available and plausible. Moreover, the Oregon Supreme Court did not say, neither did the court in Allison, anything about how those cases, Miller and Buchholz, inform the decision-making process here. That's been an argument advanced by the state since through Allison, through the lower levels of Mr. Burge's case. That's not what the Oregon Supreme Court did in the decision that we're asking this court to view as an unreasonable determination of Strickland. What the Oregon Supreme Court said was, because that statute plausibly could have been interpreted in the way the state was interpreting it, counsel had no duty to object to it. I submit that that is the extremely narrow view and an incorrect view under Strickland of the obligation of the advocate. If it's true that that statute plausibly could be argued in the state's favor, and it plausibly could be argued in the defendant's favor, then I think the Sixth Amendment requires the advocate to take the position that is in favor of the defendant, not in favor of the state. In that regard, the Oregon Supreme Court unreasonably interpreted Strickland. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Matter will stand submitted. We'll come to the final case. Noel versus Hall.